Hey guys, this is Joe. Today I want to introduce you to our partner Vanta. Achieving ISO 27001 or SOC 2 compliance can unlock major growth for your company and build customer trust, but the process can be time intense and costly. Vanta automates compliance, getting you audit ready quickly and saving up to 85% of associated costs. And Vanta scales with your business, helping you enter new markets. Join 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora that trust Vanta. Claim 20% off Vanta at vanta.com/startupradio. That's vanta.com, spelled vanta.com/startupradio.
Welcome to startuprad.io, your podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hey guys, hello and welcome everybody to a tradition of startuprad.io. We are here today for you and bringing you the FinTech Review 2023. That is an annual tradition in all the podcasts I have hosted ever since 2014, where we usually get together in a live recording that was also streamed, where we talked to fintech entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and other influential people in the fintech space and heard from them what was important to them in the past year. Right now, it turned out that the schedules of all the people are quite full, so we had to do the recordings piece by piece and we don't get like a full-on discussion, unfortunately. Nonetheless, it's very interesting. We do have together here Paolo, Luca, Ivan, and Kimmo, and each and every one of them will talk a little bit different about their perspective of fintech, banking, insurtech, embedded finance, and CBDC in 2023, and maybe a little bit about their outlook 2024. But enough said for me. I would like to welcome Paolo.
Ciao, Jorn. I'm always happy to be here, and the FinTech Review is my most important appointment of the year.
Luca.
Hey, Jorn, or Gude, as I already said last time. It's a pleasure to be back.
Ivan.
Hey, Joel. Great to be speaking. I've been great. 2023 has been an exciting year, and really looking forward to 2024 to do more great things.
And last but not least, Kimmo.
I'm doing very well. Happy Christmas. Merry Christmas, everyone. Really glad to be here today.
And before you ask, the order I welcome the people has only to do by when they could make time in the busy schedule for our recording. Paolo, you are with the IBM Institute for Business Value, the global thought leader on fintech, banking, and capital markets. We've been your perspective of 2023 and maybe a little bit your outlook 2024. And for everybody who likes Paolo, he is the most frequent guest we have on our podcast, and he is a steady guest since, I do believe, at least 5 years in our FinTech Review. You'll find down here in the show notes many of the books he's talking about and he has published, as well as his research paper. Sorry, Paolo, here's the stage to you.
2023 was a year plenty of news and advancements in technology, so it's difficult to pick up two or three of the most important. But if I may, I want to focus on a couple of elements. One is generative AI, and the other one is the rise of embedded finance. Let's start from generative AI. It's on everybody's mouth. Everybody's talking about that. Everybody wants to do it. Effectively, something is happening. We've been talking a lot through the years about the capability of building a conversational bank, but we knew that the technology was somehow limited in the capability of creating the connection with the consumers and the final users. Now this is changing. It doesn't mean that we are there yet fully, but effectively we made a huge quantum leap in that direction. I think that We can all see the history of banking investments in technology, which means opportunities for the startup this way. There are three periods in the last 10, 15 years. And I would call them a period of digitalization outright, a period of personalization with data, and a period of communication with AI. So the first period is everyone's interest and necessity to digitalize banking by launching a digital app or a digital access. So typically that means taking what existed or existed at the time, lifting shift in a sense, that's what many banks did on cloud technology, and basically power with more capability, digital connectivity with a world of consumers that could be potentially growing on the digital app compared to what has been happening in the past with the website. So that is when we saw effectively a lot of investments into architectures that can operate on cloud, so cloud technology, the hybrid cloud concept, because a lot of information is basically hosted on-prem anyway, like transactions through core banking, and the cloud becomes more and more relevant at the point of contact with the client, so powering up the mobile app. So there's the first period. We call it the digitalization outright. But then banks realized that just being on cloud and having a digital app was not enough. If we look at the net promoter scores of many banks, they fare very poorly compared to other industries. That means it is not enough to be on digital to create an entertaining and engaging enough experience that pleases the consumers, and pleases the consumers means invest consumers to effectively interact and consume on digital. And that's when banks understood that they had to personalize the digital experience. So that's when the artificial intelligence in terms of machine learning and deep learning started becoming relevant in banking investments, because all banks, the same with the startups, they started operating on mobile, needed to consume existing data that are part of core banking systems and new data, which are typically outside core banking systems, in order to make that digital proposition more relevant in front of the consumer. So that is basically the last, let's say, 5-7 years of personalization as a mantra, leveraging data, leveraging traditional artificial intelligence techniques in order to personalize what has been put on digital for the client's consumption. But here and again, and as I have, you know, well explained in all my literature, especially the last one, Banks and Fintech on Platform Economies, that might not be enough, because mobile technology, which is this one, is a technology of the demand. That means that the people might go on Amazon because they want to buy one of my books, and then my Amazon might offer something else, but people typically don't go on Google to look for the next investment opportunity. It's more complex for the majority of people. They need to get into a conversation, which makes a lot of important revenues of banking an offer-driven marketplace. Basically, products are pushed to clients. So the question is, when you move on cloud, when you move on digital and you don't have an intermediary like a human being, things happen and there are problems. So how do you put a push-oriented marketplace onto a demand-oriented technology? That's the question. That's how you crack the code. And this is where basically we saw advances starting at the beginning of this year with generative AI, because now we know that communication is the dominant element to shape the banking relationship. Communication typically is human. Now technology is getting more and more human-like, if I can say that, which sort of elevates the previous investments of banks and startups from the digitalization outright through the personalization with machine learning and deep learning into the generative AI era. Of course, this is not free of concerns. Generative AI is not a deterministic framework and algorithm. It's a probabilistic one, so it's important to find ways to control it. It's important to eliminate bias and hallucination. That's not easy, though it is feasible. We need to be humble in the way we want to use this technology. At the end, those companies will be able to apply radical transparency and good risk management will be able to use this new advancement in AI in order to, as I said, elevate their investments and power up their digital connectivity with clients a bit more. And if I can then for add, why does this matter? It matters because something is also rising that is embedded finance. I launched a paper this year, a research that is based on 12,000 consumer survey worldwide and 1,000 banking executives survey, head of open banking, embedded finance, relationship banking, transactional banking and strategy, to understand where banks are in terms of opening up their architecture, so to allow their products and solutions to be consumed by the final clients, not only on the digital apps they power, but also in the apps and super apps of third parties that operate beyond their borders. And of course, the further away you are, the more important it is, the simplification, the communication element for people to understand the value proposition. Not only, I also had the chance of talking with 22 executives of banking and non-banking institutions. They made up of what I call the voice of the maker. So try to really understand massively and also in depth what is happening in terms of embedding financial services somewhere else. You can think about buy now, pay later as an opportunity, but there's more than that in the bank insurance world, as well as the investment management perspective. Now, what I discovered is that effectively financial services shifted. I remember asking at fintech conferences before the pandemic if people had a bank account with a neobank. And I typically saw something like 60% of people raising their hand, I think, in fintech at least. There's a lot of interest and comfort in doing that. But then I asked a second question that was, how many of you consider that to be the primary relationship? So the account where you put your salary or basically you have your main savings. And usually everybody used to lower the hand. It only happened once that a guy kept the hand up and he was the founder of a new bank. So there was promotional as well. But now you see that changed. When we asked the 12,000 consumers worldwide, if they consider their neobank account, like the primary account, 16% of consumers worldwide said that they do so. And in Brazil, the number is 29%. So the extraordinary rise of new bank in Brazil, that is basically, jump-starting even the growth of the new banks and the digital proposition in some of the Asian countries. And this is also happening here in Germany. We reviewed how Germans want to consume, like pay for their consumption, looking at dining out or doing the grocery or go shopping online. Yes, Germany is, still is, a cash country, but we saw the rise of the digital wallets less than in the rest of the world, but it's rising here as well. And more interestingly, what I discovered is that I asked these 12,000 consumers and 1,000 executives the same questions. I asked the consumer, for example, what do they want from their bank? List of priorities. And I asked the bankers what they think the consumers want from their bank. And here, there's quite a gap. So basically, both of them identified security as the number one, and that's a given, right? So in a sense, banking is to be trusted, it has to be secure. But if you look at what comes right afterwards, the bankers said that consumers want instant payment and buy now, pay later. And they don't care about good customer experiences and rewards. Rewards is the least important for bankers. But you know what consumers said? Consumers said they want, in the order, good customer experience, more digital wallet, and rewards. And that's pretty interesting because I guess this is a difficulty of banks to understand how these become relevant in the digital world and what is the monetization around that, which is essential for consumers to be engaged. Not only good customer experience now can be better addressed with generative AI. For example, I worked with one of the largest payment companies in the world that used the Gen AI to understand the humongous set of conversation with clients and complaints for customer services, not just to automate them. So now it takes them something like 15 minutes to understand everything that is happening before it took him 3 weeks to summarize all type of conversations they had with clients. This example of automation, but also this becomes an opportunity as the granularity is much higher for the customer service to be more relevant. So it's an elevation of the capability of people to talk to people, right, in more meaningful ways. But what matters to me here the most is digital wallets and rewards. Rewards are basically a loyalty scheme, and loyalty is important, but it can also be expensive. You hook in clients with a reward, not necessarily clients can use the reward efficiently, so they wait on the balance sheet of the institution for a while. But now, what about to think about using digital wallets to connect consumers, retailers, with the merchants, the SMEs, which are also part of your banking relationship as a client? Now, you need a new medium for doing that. I was so happy that I was invited by the HSBC to launch this embedded finance paper on the main stage of Global Connections in Singapore in September. Because what HSBC did, they invited 100 of their top corporate clients to talk with the bank. And one of the core elements was how can a bank see the clients not anymore like clients, but partners in the embedded finance space. Now, what we're also learning is that one of the difficulties of banks is that they typically are buyers of technology. They have a hard time of selling technology. Now, the fintech are sellers of technology, not necessarily buyers of technology. And that is where, I guess, the problem is, but also the opportunity to connect the dots to facilitate, through fintech innovation, the embeddedness of financial services in seamless ways for that to be consumed by other industries. And I do believe that 2023 was the year when that was realized. 24% of the banks we surveyed said that embedded finance is core to their business strategy. It was not like that before the pandemic, and it can only be growing.
And Luca, of course, he may be known as the co-founder of Exalone, a credit risk management platform that helps institutional investors to build crowd lending loan portfolios across different platforms globally. Of course, he does have a pretty different perspective on the fintech year 2023 and maybe a little bit on the outlook. Luca, here you go.
Yeah, I think I might be talking my position here. So I think 2023 has been a bit of a roller coaster for the fintech lending space and digital lending space. And it's been fascinating to watch some of the trends. I think everybody, or most of the fintech originators that we saw in the market, they have been successful, really big fundraising rounds with institutional firepower coming in and the space professionalizing more and more. I mean, some of the players we've also seen are struggling. So it's getting tougher to fundraise from institutional investors. And it was pretty interesting to see over the course of the year, just this, you know, diverging trend. I mean, we've been on the good side of it, fortunately. Then also going forward, I think it's pretty interesting that, you know, it's not only the segment of fintech lending and digital lending that is gaining more traction, more awareness from institutional investors. But what I find interesting is that you really see ecosystems starting to converge. And I'm saying that because, you know, there is more and more appetite also from what we see in the digital asset space to actually connect to source, you know, real world assets. And my guess, if I would have to make a prediction for 2024, is that, you know, fintech lending or digital lending and, you know, tokenization and the digital asset ecosystem are going to start to be more intertwined going forward, in the sense that it's, in my guess, not only going to be, you know, traditional wrappers or traditional investment vehicles like funds or securitized notes and the like, but we will probably see a lot of more tokenization going forward as an alternative wrapper to, you know, lending or loan portfolios. Well, so far, a recent transaction was announced, for instance, from Fasanara Capital. They have created, I believe, you know, a tokenized tranche or tokenized loan portfolio, and if I'm not much mistaken, Very recently, we saw Taylor, for instance, also coming in with a tokenized part of their SME loan portfolio. And my guess is that we will be seeing more of that going forward. No, I think it was really so far, you know, this new element of investment vehicles that are starting to get digitized. I mean, in a way, you can see, you know, you have the digital front end of SME lending and the processes. And then on the other end, you know, you're starting to see more or less the liability side to be digitized with a different approach. But overall, you know, I think the trend is recurring that, you know, in fintech lending, especially with rising interest rates, that might come down over the next year, as hinted by some central banks. But I mean, the overall state of the economy, as well as, you know, possibility about a recession and some wobbles and then, you know, the emergence or, you know, let's say from the investor side, a bit of an increased mindfulness about possible rising defaults, that's probably going to shape the risk management in digital lending also going forward. And it has already been a key focus point in some of the discussions that we've had also with institutional investors and fintech lenders. So I think that's really going to be key. And just, you know, having the right tools in place to be able to control the risk in loan portfolios on a granular level or to screen the loan portfolios better. I think that's really going to be key for investors going forward in order to, you know, to have a bridge or to have a way for institutional capital to continue flowing into that sector. And then maybe, yeah, sorry if I may jump in. And obviously, there was also one comment that I found quite interesting that obviously, you know, with rising interest rates, you know, there is this thing called demand elasticity of credit. So obviously, you know, the higher the rates charged to borrowers, the more impact this has, the more negative impact this can have on obviously, you know, credit demand. And so we've seen, for instance, also one recent post from October that they also saw that, you know, due to the rising interest rates, it's not actually only, you know, a better prospect for investors in that sense, of higher spreads that can be earned. But then again, you know, it's also a tale of how do you balance as a fintech originator, how do you balance the demand side of things, right? Because if you need to pass on higher interest rates to borrowers, then it's getting tougher to attract, you know, to attract actually supply or interest from borrowers. And so finding the right balance between these two sides, I think that's crucial. That's key.
And of course, there is Ivan. Ivan is the co-founder of an embedded finance startup called Monite, and we also had in our interview based in Berlin. Of course, he also does have a quite different perspective on what was this year all about. So I give the stage to Ivan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for 2023 for us has been sort of just like for everyone in the startup markets, observing a shift from being all this like cool, innovative startup companies that sort of like do some cool stuff and then figure out how to make it work as a business and break even, etc., to actually like, you know, a really, really crazy level of diligence, how to make it a business already now, how to watch unit economics closely. And not only this happened for us and other players in the market, but also for our potential customers. And in our market, the behavior largely shifted from trying to build stuff to actually being almost a default buy in embedded accounts payable and receivable that we do at Monite. So that's been a big one. And then another big trend we observed is that actually, you know, the journey of startups seems to be very, very affected by public markets and by what's happening with capital availability to a shocking extent, right? So it's been also a shaky year for many companies. A lot of companies didn't survive the year. A lot of companies struggled. And so I think it's been a tough year. And so for all of those who are still in the game, I think that's an achievement by itself. Raising any money this year was an achievement. Keeping good people around was an achievement. So it's been a tough year that also brought a lot of great opportunities around. And I think, at least to me, being in the startup industry for, you know, over 10 years, this is the first year where I can say that startups are really shifting to become closer to real businesses. So that's my short recap of 23, but overall positive and really looking forward into 2024. Yeah, for 2024, look, my outlook is actually positive. I think we'll continue seeing, you know, hard conditions to raise capital. We'll continue seeing that businesses, that startups need to become businesses in many ways, right? Show good unit economics, that multiples will be lower than in 2021, right? And all this stuff. So this shift that I talked about in 23 will continue. And then I have a couple of interesting predictions when it comes to what I expect to happen in 2024. One of them is a large talent migration. I think at least I would predict that there will be a wave of people migrating. Some of that will be from late stage companies that are now a little bit stuck. It's hard to raise money post Series B or even for Series B. So a lot of people who are in an exciting growth trajectory will find themselves in stagnation, will look for more opportunities. And this wave will split into two main buckets, in my view, right? So the first bucket will become founders. And that's where we see a lot of pre-seed activity happening already now, with like XWise, XRevolut, X this and that type of people going to market, investors willing to fund it, investors willing to take risks, but also different conditions apply in terms of business model and economics. And then the second part of these guys, actually, with what I'm seeing, could join some early stage companies like Monite, like Seed or Series A. But also, I expect a portion of them to go into corporates and into incumbents. And so I think we'll see a lot of talent migration from some types of companies to other types of companies. And also, we'll see companies going bust. Probably there will be a lot of them going bust, which means that there will be more and more talent available in the market. A lot of great people will become available and more technology will be created, but also there will be great opportunity for businesses that are doing well to hire some new additional great talent. So that's my first prediction, basically a large migration we see in the startup world, or a fairly large. And then the second prediction, kind of going from the first one, I think what we're starting to see, and this might sound very controversial, but what we are starting to see is that incumbents are actually getting a lot cleverer. In fact, some of the banks we're talking to at Monite, like, they hired great people. They actually have really good teams in place, and the tide is shifting. These guys are not as behind as they used to be. Some of them become even leaders in some parts of, for example, embedded finance. And they are very, very much in a great position now with interest rates being high, especially banks, right? And other incumbents as well. Their business is actually doing really well. They're able and willing to attract top talent. They're changing in many ways how they think about product strategy and vision. And I think when we talked about all these incumbents like a few years back, everybody was like, yeah, these guys are like forever behind. So I think this forever is starting to turn for now, or maybe even kind of starting to turn into another direction where some of these incumbents might actually catch up very quickly because they have money to throw at it. And if they get the right people on board, for which the timing is actually really good right now, then they're in a great position to, you know, build something good, to buy some good companies, to really spin off the right propositions to clients. And in the end, they are actually in a very comfortable position compared to a lot of challengers out there, fortunately or unfortunately. So my second prediction is that we'll see incumbents becoming stronger, not weaker. There will be exceptions, of course, right? Not every incumbent will make it, but I think we'll see a couple of really successful examples in 24. And then my third prediction is a little bit more in the area of fintech. I think the whole embedded finance theme has been challenged very, very hard in the last year or two, with a lot of fintechs going down, a lot of embedded finance players supplying fintechs also not feeling great. And so what I think is going to happen is that a lot of embedded finance that survives will actually go up market and start serving enterprise customers with real use cases. And then the second point here is the real use cases really matter. We used to live in a world with a lot of visionary selling, with a lot of like signed contracts, with a lot of vanity value being created, or like sort of visionary value being created, but without economic proof. I think these times are gone now. And in 24, I expect to see even stricter diligence on why embedded something makes sense specifically in these plays. So that's my outlook for fintech. And while it sounds banal, I think we have never seen such a level of like diligence and deep dive by investors, by experts, by customers as we see now. And signed revenue or signed contracts or people like regularly not going live, which used to be the norm in embedded finance for a few years, I think will stop being the norm, and we'll see the evolution of proper business cases. And we'll also see, again, some players probably either needing to shift the model or feeling really bad just because the market will be very tough in terms of raising financing when the revenue doesn't get real fast enough. And this is, of course, one of the challenges for Monad as well that we look forward to solving in 2024.
Last but not least, Kimmo, our specialist for central bank digital currency and advisor to central banks, is here with us from London. He, of course, has also quite different perspective on what was going on in the fintech and finance world in 2023. Kimmo, please go ahead.
I think the clear two main topics this year have been liquidity and fraud. And there are sort of specific reasons, I think, for both. So if I start maybe with liquidity, of course, the interest rates going up. So that makes money more expensive, and that makes liquidity more expensive. And that makes optimizing liquidity more important for pretty much everyone, like from large banks, global banks, to smaller banks, to corporates, to small fintech enterprises like ourselves. Liquidity is a very important topic. And so, Joe, you know that we work mostly around payments, and that's why I've been also here on these central bank digital currency broadcasts. We've been pretty much over the last two decades already been working with large value payment systems like CHAPS in the UK, where banks make payments with each other to make them more liquidity efficient. And I think the ones that we were simulating together with the Bank of England maybe a decade ago helped the UK banks save 4 billion in liquidity in that system from 20, so quite a large percentage as well. And so what we've been doing in the last couple of years is bring that type of technology for the banks as well, so that the banks can compress their liquidity holdings, so how much money they're holding or buffers they're holding for being able to make all the payments that their customers ask them to do or that they want to make by themselves for the proprietary activities that they're doing. So I think that's been really, really something that's kicked off this year because the environment has changed from a long time of zero interest rates into really having positive interest rates, and everyone is experiencing that hit, how the liquidity is like actually getting costly. In some other countries, we're also thinking about mechanisms for corporates to optimize their liquidity. This is not maybe on an intraday basis, but on a longer term basis, sort of looking at mechanisms how we could, when there is information about all the invoices that companies have sent each other, to say that, hey, what if this company would pay earlier to that company so that company could pay earlier to that company so that company could pay earlier to the next company? In order to, in that way, in a way, optimize the whole economy, then create buffers, excess capital that the companies now would be holding, so that they could be making investments or not having to cut down their operations or staff because they hit liquidity problems, which I think sort of is a rather big idea, and I've been advocating it pretty much the whole year in different parts of the world, and we're getting quite a bit of traction in a number of countries who are sort of thinking that could help protect the downside when the economy is not doing well, but then also create quite a competitive advantage when things are going well, because everyone in the economy just gets paid earlier and needs less operating capital to do so. And the second piece around fraud, I think that's So if the liquidity is usually a question when we have larger amounts of larger payments between banks or large corporates, the fraud is something that really touches, I think, everyone. Probably everyone has received emails trying to get their bank details or make them payments to someone, or scams that try to get to your monies. And I think in the past, pretty much after COVID, a lot of countries started to bring a lot of new consumers into the realm of digital payments, sort of a financial inclusion and digitization of the economies has meant that we have now in large parts of the world faster payment systems. So it's very easy to move money from one person to another. It's instantaneous. But at the same time, we have brought in hundreds of millions of people that used to use cash and now have to learn how to use digital payments. So they're very profitable targets for international gangs to target and try to scam them out of their monies. So I think this is happening a lot in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, but also I think in Europe. But I think it comes just in very many forms. So what we are sort of working mostly is around what we call consumer fraud. So consumers getting scammed, they're making payments to fraudsters they don't want to make payments to. And then these fraudsters are onward muling the monies very quickly in the instant payment system, trying to conceal the source of the money and then take it out in cash or crypto or move it somewhere out from the system. So there's a sort of window of opportunity to help them actually stop those payments and then return the monies to the victim. Yeah. So what happens is that the fraudsters, when they get their money quickly through the faster payment systems or instant payment systems from the victims, they start to move it around through mule accounts within the system many times. So in 20 minutes, it can already have moved several accounts forward. And of course, that creates it very difficult to recover that money to the victim. As a consequence, I think a lot of people are losing trust into digital payments, the same way that I don't answer phone calls anymore because most of them are scam or spam, or I'm very distrustful on any SMSs that I receive because they probably lead to links that I should not be clicking. And we don't want that same thing happen to payment systems because they're too critical for the functioning of the economy. And especially in countries that have digitized very quickly, there's real risk that large amounts of people start to consider them just distrustful and stop using them and return back to using cash, which of course is much less efficient for the sort of like economy than being able to make purchases online and pay online.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I wish Happy New Year to everyone. 2024 will be an amazing year for innovation.
Awesome. Thanks, Jörn. The same to you. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas and Happy Coming New Year.
Merry Christmas, everyone, from my behalf as well. And more exciting and positive news for the next year.
It has been a great pleasure to have you all here in the FinTech Review 2023. Hope to see you soon again. Everybody out there, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Frohe Weihnachten und einen guten Rutsch.
That's all, folks. Find more news, streams, events, and interviews at www.startuprad.io. Remember, sharing is caring.